Okay, so hello everyone. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to give this talk here, and apologies for giving an electronic talk, but I think I'm not very good at drawing these two-dimensional structure factors, and I don't want you just to take the message that it takes a really long time to draw these things, so I'm giving an electronic talk here. So what I'm going to be talking about today starts with some prehistory on where the kind of Dymer models I'm going to be concentrating on in this talk come from. Then some history on what kind of phases you get in them. And then I'm going to try to move ahead and to some things which are rather more recent and some unpublished problems, and make some links to problems of cooperative paramagnetism, or also known as classical spin liquids, which I've been working on very recently. And then try to feed some of this back to talking about excitations of these RVB liquids. This is a research effort which spans several years, and the number of collaborators has been accumulating steadily. So all of this started with Premi Chandra and Shivaji Sondhi when I came to Princeton, but a lot of people have been added since. I think I'll be talking about work which these people were involved in over the years. So I'd just like to mention them all at the outset. Okay, so for this audience, I think I can go relatively rapidly over this slide. So even though the three-dimensional work I'm going to be discussing later on is not particularly closely related to the microscopics of high TC, but this is really the historical starting point, and so I'd just like you to bear with me in the beginning here. So here is the high TC phase diagram, very well known by now. And this really takes up at a point which Subir, there's many intersections between what I'm saying today and what Subir said yesterday. So the basic observation that all of this starts from is that if you have a symmetry broken state and you let a hole hop through it, you create domain walls. So here you start with a Néel state, which is basically the parent state of the high TCs. You let a hole hop through, and as it hops through, it shuffles the spins it encounters behind it, in the process creating these domain walls, which are very costly in magnetic energy. And so this is what's known as the hole motion being frustrated in the high TC problem. And so basically the question is, how can you start with a symmetry broken state and then get a state where, in some sense, the superconducting order parameter is an indication that the hole kinetic energy is realized very well, in the sense that the holes can move around without encountering any resistance. So the question is, how do you resolve the competition between hole kinetic energy and the Néel symmetry broken state? And there are many different resolutions, and this is not a talk about what the possible resolutions are. I'd just like to mention that one of them, which was advanced rather early, is that actually the parent state of the superconductor is more easily thought of not as this Néel state, but as a different magnetic phase known as the resonating valence bond liquid phase, which I'll explain in the next transparency, which crucially does not break any symmetries, unlike the Néel state, which breaks the symmetry and therefore stops the hole from hopping around. The basic idea here is that rather than having a Néel type state, you start with the kind of state which a pair of spins a half is most happy with, antiferromagnetically speaking, and that's a singlet bond. So if you have a single pair of electrons coupled spins a half coupled antiferromagnetically, they're going to form a singlet bond, also known as valence bond, which I'm going to denote by a dimer in the following. So the basic RVB scenario then is the following. So as I just said, if you have a single pair of spins a half, a singlet bond, a valence bond, or dimer is really the optimal state for the thing to be in. So this is the kind of dimer I'm drawing here. But you see immediately, if you have a higher coordination for your system, then you can only form a dimer with one neighbor, whereas the Néel state gains some magnetic energy from all of its neighbors. So here that seems to favor the Néel state, and in fact, if you have infinitely coordinated system, you know that the Néel state is the ground state. However, a given spin isn't forced quantum mechanically to form a dimer or a singlet bond either with one neighbor or another. This is what I've tried to indicate here. Rather, you can have these resonance moves. So you can have a pair of dimers which are horizontal and switch them into a pair of dimers which are vertical. And in the process of doing this, you can get a superposition of these two states. And due to the superposition, you can gain some quantum mechanical delocalization energy. So this is this basic resonance move, which has been stolen from benzene, which is why this is called resonating valence bond. because in benzene you have these valence bonds, two ways of pairing valence bonds around the six-membered loop of carbons here. And so the idea is that even though the Néel state gains energy from each of its neighbor, the energy from the resonance can make up part of the energy difference between the RVB state and the Néel state. And now the decider between the two in this scenario is that once you start doping holes, as I just said, in the Néel state, the motion is frustrated. The holes can't really gain in a straightforward way their kinetic energy. Whereas in this liquid, so here I've drawn a cartoon of a liquid, you can imagine taking a dimer, removing one electron, so that you're left with this hole and the unpaired spin next to it. And then this hole can simply move around, shuffling the dimers it encounters behind it, and thereby realizing some kinetic energy. So the idea is that upon hole doping, the difference, the RVB state is favored because the holes can more easily realize their kinetic energy than in the Néel state. So here you see this very important concept, which just comes out of this in this cartoon, where by removing one electron, you've created two distinct quasi-particles, a spin-on and a hole-on, and these two can move independently of one another. So this is the phenomenon of having quantum number fractionalization in a background RVB liquid phase. So it's quantum number fractionalization because the quantum numbers which were originally carried by the electron spin a half and charge E are now carried by the hole and the hole-on and the spin-on separately. So really where the basic starting point from what I'm going to be talking about in the following lies is the observation that you can take into account the single occupancy constraint of this mod insulator physics, that there's more or less one, but certainly not two electrons per site, by going to the effective degrees of freedom, which is the singlet bond. And now you've got this new degree of freedom. You no longer really talk about spins a half. You have a singlet bond and these fractionalized excitations. And then the question is, what happens if you add quantum dynamics, so these are these resonance moves, to the ensemble of the states, which you denote by dimer coverings of the lattice? So I'd like to put this under the heading of local constraints in quantum dynamics. So in the theory of correlated electrons, hard constraints are really quite ubiquitous. So the single occupancy constraint I just mentioned is one example. Now, if you can choose somehow, if you're lucky that you can find a way of encoding these effective degrees of freedom, such as that you get rid of spins a half and you're just left with dimers, then you can get rid of this constraint by the choice of your Hilbert space. But the price you pay for this, in some sense, is that you're left with not one vector in your Hilbert space, but an exponentially large basis, an exponentially large number of dimer coverings of a given lattice. And then you ask if on top of this, you now take into account the quantum dynamics, what happens? So in the dimer model, you have this quantum dynamics of the plaquette flip. So if you've got a flippable plaquette with two horizontal dimers, you can change it into two vertical dimers. And then you've got a hard problem. You've got an extensively degenerate classical system of dimer coverings. You add quantum dynamics, and the question is what happens? And this is really the overarching question I'm going to be discussing today. What happens to a classically exponentially degenerate system if you add quantum dynamics? So this is a non-perturbative problem. I mean, since the dimer states have all the same energy to start with before you add quantum dynamics, you have an extensively degenerate perturbation theory to do, and this is non-perturbative. But it's also potentially very interesting, and I like to appeal to the case of the quantum Hall effect, which is rather similar. There you start with a degenerate Landau level, you add perturbations, and you know that very rich behavior ensues if you do that. Okay, so the easing model of this kind of, in this field, I think you can, is the Roxar-Kivelson quantum dimer model. The Roxar-Kivelson quantum dimer model precisely captures this quantum dynamics within the state, within the space of dimer coverings of a lattice. So the resonance move that I've mentioned a few times already is pictorially denoted by taking a plaquette and flipping it by 90 degrees. We call such plaquettes flippable plaquettes. So you can define this on any sort of lattice. This is the dimer model on, this is the pictorial representation of the dimer model on the square lattice, and here it is in the triangular lattice. Basically, you always take the shortest closed loop of even length, and you you resonate between one way of pairing these sites up into dimers and another. So this is the basic simple resonance flip. Then, in addition, there's a term known as the potential term, which simply counts the number of flippable plaquettes. I'm not aware of a particularly controlled way of introducing this Hamiltonian, but it's basically been extremely useful for a number of reasons. And the main reason why it's so useful is that it enables you in a rather controlled way to tune between a number of different phases and types of behaviors. And I'd like to give you some reasons why this kind of model Hamiltonian is very useful in the theoretical study of such models. Okay, so first, notice there's one free parameter, the relative strength of the potential to the kinetic term, V over T. So we are going to be sitting at zero temperature for the rest of this talk, just to avoid the, because we're in the position to avoid these unnecessary experimental complications that we talked about yesterday. So one of the things that is really, this is a trick, but it's a trick which is extremely useful and has been used over and over again. So Roxanne Kivelsen noticed that the equal time correlations at a particular value of V over T, namely V over T equal to 1, of the ground state of this Hamiltonian are given exactly by a classical calculation. So if you tell me that you want to sit at V over T equal to 1, I can give you the exact ground state wave function. And to get correlators, all I have to do is about do a classical calculation. And like this, we basically have a non-perturbative problem with one point, which is essentially soluble. I mean, whether it's exactly solvable or not is one question, but certainly since it's a classical problem, you can always make progress in the worst case using classical Monte Carlo. And so whenever you make progress by looking at classical models, often you can simply feed this back and make progress about one particular point in the Roxanne-Kivelsen quantum dimer model. And in the later part of this talk, I'm actually going to give you one example of where we have been able to solve something classically, which we can then feed back into this Roxanne-Kivelsen type model. The other thing is rather obvious. There are two limits which you can solve exactly here. So one is, it's basically the limits when the diagonal term, the potential term, dominates, because then this is simply a classical maximization problem. If V is much larger than T, you can forget about the quantum dynamics. And so the limits of V over T larger than 1 and V over T going to minus infinity usually give you two generic types of phases known as the staggered and columnar phases, which I'm showing on the next transparency. So here's the phase diagram for the square lattice. This probably looks familiar after yesterday's talk. So as I mentioned, for V over T larger than 1, you get a staggered phase. Basically, it's not advantageous to have any flippable plaquettes here, and this is one state which realizes that. For V over T larger negative, you get the so-called columnar phase, where the dimers form columns. And you see that this was, again, the picture that Subir showed yesterday. If you now break up one of these dimers and move one of the quasi-particles along, you introduce a domain wall. And this is not favorable energetically. And so what you see is that this kind of state is confining. So the original hope that by going to this dimer type model to describe the RVB liquid, that you would get something, a state which enables the hole to hop around easily, has not been fulfilled. So in particular, they're actually only confining phases here. So these are all different solids. They all break translational symmetry. But once you take an electron and a hole and hop it through here, in every single one of these cases, the thing will be confined. So the original motivation of the RVB scenario is certainly not realized in this context here. So this is really important. All phases are confining. And so therefore, this short-range RVB approach within this model doesn't seem to realize the route to superconductivity which was envisioned. There's one nice little phenomenon here, which is that the Roxanne-Kivelsen point itself turns out to be deconfined at zero temperature. So you've got this phenomenon that all the phases are confined, but actually the critical point itself is deconfined. And one other nice feature is that the Roxanne-Kivelsen point itself is actually highly degenerate. There turn out to be many different dynamically disjoint sectors of the Roxanne-Kivelsen model, all of which are degenerate exactly at this point. So the Roxanne-Kivelsen point here is exactly solvable, but it also turns out to be a very special point, which is basically totally different from all of the other points in the phase diagram. So why are we pretty confident that this is the correct phase diagram? Well, for one thing, there's been a lot of work on this over the years, and I think everyone more or less agrees on that. The other thing is that one can write down a long wavelength theory which captures this kind of behavior. And the crucial ingredient into this long wavelength theory is basically only that the square lattice is bipartite. And you'll see this in the next transparency, how that works.
The transition between the plaquette and the columnar phase, is that a continuous transition?
That's, no one's really checked that, but it's almost certainly first order. Right. I mean, we've checked it for the hexagonal quantum diamond model. I mean, you can, okay, so unless it's deconfined critical, I mean, the Landau theory certainly tells you to expect a first order transition. Basically, because this one breaks translational symmetry in two directions, and this one breaks translational symmetry in one direction and rotational symmetry. So these two things are symmetry incompatible.
You look at the height model, also, first order.
Right. Okay, so this is one of the central bits of theory in this talk. So since you have a bipartite lattice, you're able to orient the dimers in the on the lattice so that, say, you take a red and a blue sublattice, and you orient each of the dimers to point from the red to the blue sublattice. And now you assign a lattice flux to each of these dimers. You say if there's a dimer on a link, you call it a flux of 3. And if there's no dimer on a link, you call it a flux of minus 1. And then you see that at each site, there are 3 units of flux coming in and 3 units of flux going out. So if you call this flux B, then you notice, you can simply rephrase this, that the lattice divergence of this flux is 0. And you know how to treat something like this. Then you simply call the flux a divergence of a vector potential A, a curl of a vector potential A. And now the special thing that happens in two dimensions is that this vector potential can actually be represented by a scalar, basically because the vector has two components. You've got one constraint, divergence is 0, so you're left with 1 degree of freedom per side. And so this you can encode by the scalar H, and this scalar H is called the height. So there are many other ways of deriving this height model, but this is the one which turns out will generalize to higher dimensions. So this is a scalar height function. In particular, what this means is that you have no local gauge invariance. So unlike you normally expect in a gauge theory like this to have local gauge invariance, but actually this height model is only invariant under global shifts of the height everywhere together. The reason one does this kind of thing is that the mapping to the height now takes care of the hardcore constraint. By going to this kind of dual variable, you've gotten rid of that constraint. And whereas constraints are naturally rather hard to coarse grain, once you've taken care of this constraint, you can now hope that the theory in terms of the heights is going to look more simple than that. So what one then does, and this is simply an ansatz, and one has to check whether it actually works on a case-to-case basis, is that we first look at the classical height model. So H is the variable I just introduced, being basically the vector potential for the dimers. So the classical point, there's a long venerable literature, starting with Bloet and Nightingale and Hillhorst a long time ago, who basically had this idea of coarse-graining the heights to get a coarse-grained height H tilde. And then, then the important observation here is that if you look at a plaquette which is flippable like this one, you notice that the flux averaged over the plaquette is 0, because this flux exactly cancels that, and the same thing for the vertical fluxes. And so if the flux averaged is 0, then since the flux is proportional to a derivative of H, you'd expect that a 0 flux configuration is going to have a very small gradient of the height. But an average flux of 0 corresponds to a plaquette which is flippable, that is to say when you coarse grain, the configurations which give you 0 flux actually correspond to several microscopic configurations, say here this one and the one with the two dimers flipped, whereas the configurations which don't average to 0, such as this one where you have a dimer which is not flippable, actually give you, so this gives you a non-zero average flux which points upwards, and it also only corresponds to one microstate. So the basic thing that you should take away from this is that if the height is flat upon coarse graining, it means that there are a lot of microstates corresponding to one particular coarse grain configuration. And the way you try to capture this is by introducing an effective action, which basically just consists of the Gaussian term, the gradient of the H squared. So a flat configuration is going to have a very good weighting, whereas a strongly fluctuating fluctuation, say one where there's a very strong constant tilt, has got a rather bad energy to it. And if you do this, you are in fact able to reproduce the classical Roxak-Hilson point correlations asymptotically. Of course, not at a short distance, because this is a coarse grain description. Now, if you want to describe the quantum problem, what we basically did is we tried to guess what is the effective long wavelength theory here. So you start from a two-dimensional classical problem, you go to a 2+1-dimensional quantum problem. You again keep the terms which are allowed, such as a gradient in H, gradient square in H, and so on. And then you have to ask upon this coarse graining procedure, which are the terms which will be generated by the RG. And it turns out, since the H's start off naturally as being integers, you have to add a term like this, where the coarse grained H's remember that they're really coming from a variable which likes to be an integer. And now with this kind of trial action, you say, how can we fit this to the phase diagram that we've observed? And I've told you a few of the qualitative behaviors already. So one thing that you notice is that when rho 2 changes sign, you go from a situation where you want the average tilde of the height to be zero to a situation where the average tilde of the height wants to be maximal. And it turns out, as I said before, that large tilde of the height means very little flippability. It turns out that the staggered state I showed you earlier is the one which has got the maximal tilde, whereas the other confining phases, like Plaquette and columnar, in fact have zero tilde. So this suggests that rho 2 goes through zero at the Roxhart-Kivelsen point, where you change between the flat state and the maximally tilted state. The other thing which this shows you is that if rho 2 is zero, then there's no longer a dependence on grad h squared, but the next leading dependence is on del squared h. So what that tells you is that the energy becomes insensitive to the average gradient of the height, as long as the gradient is uniform. And this basically accounts for the degeneracy at the Roxhart-Kivelsen point I mentioned earlier. So like this, we've reproduced the fact that it's flat on one side, maximally staggered on the other, and degenerate at the Roxhart-Kivelsen point itself. This operator here, cosine 2 pi h, in fact turns out to be dangerously irrelevant. And that is to say, from out of the flat states, this is the thing that chooses either the Plaquette or the columnar state, this depends on the value of lambda, as you go to the left of the Roxhart-Kivelsen point. And so I'm not going to talk about this deconfined critical business here. I hope that one of my collaborators is going to have the opportunity to speak about that later on in the workshops. I'm not going to cover this, but basically the ordering through the dangerously relevant operator is what gives you this deconfined Roxhart-Kivelsen point adjacent to only confining phases. So with this kind of action, we've been able to capture the long wavelength behavior of the Roxhart-Kivelsen model for the entire phase diagram, essentially. The one thing that's not clear in here is why lambda changes sign at some point, thereby giving you a transition from the columnar to the Plaquette state. Okay, so we started by saying, let's look at high TC superconductors, write down a quantum Dymond model, look for a liquid phase, and this would be the parent state of the superconductor. And what we found is that actually there's no RVB liquid. So this left open the question, do actually all quantum Dymond models order the same way that, for example, all ferromagnets order? Or is this just that the number of quantum Dymond models one has looked at actually don't cover the full range of behaviors of these quantum Dymond models? And as I've tried to argue that it's really this bipartiteness which gives you this quantum height model, which was a crucial ingredient, because in d equals 2 plus 1, these height models are never in the rough phase. And you would need a rough phase to get this liquid type of behavior. So there are several directions we can take in order to get around that. So one is you go away from a bipartite lattice to a non-bipartite lattice, so like the triangular RVB, the triangular lattice. And the other one is, instead of being in two dimensions, you go to three dimensions, so you go to the cubic lattice, or you do both through the FCC lattice, and it turns out you find RVB liquids in each of these cases. So without going into details of how one obtains this, let me just tell you what happens to the triangular, to the Roxhart-Kivelsen model on the triangular lattice. So this is again the generic phase diagram. You get at large negative V, you get a confining solid at large at V over T larger than 1. You also get a confining solid. This is the non-flippable one. This is the flippable one. And it turns out that you can solve exactly the correlations at the Roxhart-Kivelsen point itself. So this is something we've done in some detail together with Paul Fendley, who's in the audience today. And you can show that any possible dimer correlation function that you can write down actually decays exponentially and actually rather rapidly exponentially. So this really, for this particular point, you can really show that this is part of an RVB liquid phase which is gapped. And then it's quite a bit harder to argue that this extends for a finite range of fields. But anyway, what we find for the triangular lattice is that in the absence of this height representation for bipartite lattice, you do get an RVB liquid which has this deconfining phase for monomers. This is something we also checked in a calculation. So it does realize electron fractionalization. It turns out to have a gapped excitation spectrum. And another feature which it has is topological order, which is a novel kind of order, which I'm going to explain on the next transparency. But basically, the important result here, just to cap this, is that if you go away from a bipartite model, you will be able, not always, but in a lot of cases, to find a phase where there's an RVB liquid, most simply represented here on the triangular lattice. So to finish off the two-dimensional part of this talk, I'd just like to briefly explain topological order in this context here, because I think this is the simplest context in which you can describe topological order. So consider this one component cartoon of a wave function of an RVB liquid. So here I've just drawn one dimer covering, which is part of that wave function. And I've drawn one cut here in blue. This is an imaginary line, which you're supposed to think of as winding around the periodic boundary conditions so that it closes back on itself. And now you count how many dimers does this line cross. And this number is going to be either even or odd. And whether it's even or odd, you define a winding parity, even or odd like that. And the important thing is that a local Hamiltonian has no matrix elements between the even and the odd winding parity solutions. And the reason for that you can see from this cartoon as well. If you have the basic Plaquette flip, which takes two dimers, which are horizontal, and flips them over onto the two red dashed lines, you change the total number of dimers which this cut crosses by two. You always change it by an even number unless you flip a loop which winds all around the system, which is something you can't do with a local operator. So that is to say, if you have any local operator, you cannot distinguish between the RVB liquid in the even and the odd sector for a thermodynamically large system. That is to say, even though you don't break any symmetry, the state by construction breaks no symmetries, there's actually an exact degeneracy in the thermodynamic limit between the even and the odd sector. And just to make contact to another stream of interest which has come out of this, is that it's been suggested that you could actually use this even or oddness as a basis set for a qubit. The basic idea here is that this would be immune to local noise, because if you've got some local source of noise, since you can't tell between the even and the odd sector, that also means that the local noise can't lead to a relative dephasing, because otherwise you could tell between the even and the odd sector by looking at the relative dephasing of the two winding parity states. This is one thing that's supposed to be good. The other thing that's supposed to be very attractive here is that you can in principle use this as a scalable system. So here I've drawn a wafer of triangular lattice. You punch lots of holes in it. Each hole comes with its own winding parity cut. And so as a matter of principle, you might be able to construct a wafer of qubits, one for each hole, on a triangular RVB liquid. So the two advantages here would be immunity to local noise and also scalability. Of course, the reason that you can't buy these yet is that there are some limits. For example, if you want to make logic operations with it, of course, you can't do them locally because you can't tell between the two states locally. So it has to be something global, and these things are not necessarily so simple to do. But anyway, I mean, it's not clear whether this is worse than taking an array of atomic force microscopes. Let's see how you can generalize this to other cases. So I said one thing you can do is you can start with two dimensions and go to a non-bipartite lattice. The other thing you can do is you can go to three dimensions and ask what happens there. So let's start with a classical case again, so at the Roxar-Kivelsen point. And there we use the same analogy as before. We can again orient the dimers to have five fluxes in one direction if they are present and minus one flux if they're absent. You again get divergence of B equals zero. You write B as the curl of a vector potential. And now this is a proper vector potential. It's no longer just a scalar. And by the same kind of arguments, that we present that were used in the square lattice model, you can again do a coarse graining. You effectively again save the local field average to zero. You give it a high Boltzmann weight. If it averages to something large, you give it a low Boltzmann weight. So you have this kind of action again. And if you work this out, this is basically then just the correlators of a dipolar problem. What you find are these dipolar correlators. For example, if a spin, if a dimer points in the x direction and a second dimer at distance r at an angle theta also points in the x direction, the correlator is 3 cosine squared theta minus 1 over r cubed. So I haven't shown you how this calculation goes, but it's a moderately standard thing. And so this is a prediction that you can check against classical Monte Carlo. And you find, so I'm here for a essentially infinite size system. I've plotted this CXX quantity multiplied by r cubed so that it goes to a constant at large distances for 4 different values of the angle theta. And you find that A, it flattens out. We've been able to determine the exponent here, but this is 3 to within 1%. And it follows the 3 cosine squared theta minus 1 law again to within the noise of the measurement that we were able to take numerically here. One thing we did just in order to have another control on the simulations is we looked at the finite size correlations. So here this is just system L equals 32. And while we don't this is a long wavelength theory, we asked what happens if you just put this theory on a lattice, so you just do the dumbest lattice regularization that you can think of. And it turns out if you compare the simulated results with the theory, A, it captures the finite size effects correctly, and B, it qualitatively, but not quantitatively, captures the short distance deviation from the long distance result. And I'll come back to that in a different context later on. Basically, here one remarkable thing is, so three-dimensional models are usually not solvable. So we can't solve this in the sense that we don't know what the entropy is at zero, the entropy of the dimer model is, but we are able to give rather accurate expressions for the correlations of this model. So really what comes now is more or less just applying known results to these kind of theories and translating them into dimer language. So the quantum problem, again, we started from a three-dimensional classical model at the RK point. Then we promote this to a quantum problem, which gives us a 3 plus 1 dimensional model. The action then, I've again written here as, I've written this in gauge invariant language. So this was the, in the two-dimensional version, this was grad h squared. This was del squared h squared. And this was the d tau of h squared. So this is basically the quantum electrodynamics action in 3 plus 1 dimensions. The important feature, again, is that as for the exactly the same arguments as before, rho 2 goes through 0 at the Roxar-Killerson point, so that you have a rather strange electrodynamics which with E squared and essentially a del squared B squared term here. But as rho 2 moves away from, goes to a positive value, you enter a different phase, which in this kind of game is the Coulomb phase. So if rho 2 is not equal to 0, this is the action of compact quantum electrodynamics. But microscopically, we have zero divergence of the magnetic field. That means that you've got monopoles suppressed. And this means that just by the standard law of this field, that you're in the RVB Coulomb liquid phase here. So that is to say, here you've got deconfinement. That is to say, if you have two monomers, they only interact via the 1 over r electrostatic potential in three dimensions, which is not confining. I'll come to the excitations later on if I have time. So these actually support gapless photon excitations. And it's also a realization of what Zhao Gan has called quantum order. But anyway, so this is really an important result again, that this was the second option. You go from two dimensions to three dimensions. You keep bipartiteness. And you're able to generate an RVB liquid in 3 plus 1 dimensions. It's got, as before, as all these Roxar-Killerson models, it's got a staggered phase, either confining solid phases, which haven't been looked at in detail yet, and an RVB phase. You might ask, so why does this have an RVB phase and not the square lattice case? So the basic difference is that there was this dangerously irrelevant operator lambda cosine 2 pi h in two dimensions. This operator is not gauge invariant in three dimensions, which is why it's absent. I should also say that no one's yet checked this numerically, so this is just pure, basically using this ansatz and asking you how far it gets. So as I mentioned before, you can do the same thing on a non-bipartite three-dimensional lattice, but I'm not going to go into that in detail. The only thing I'd like to say is that you might now think, if it's so much easier to get a liquid phase in three dimensions, why haven't people found these liquid-type phases in three-dimensional magnets? So one possibility is, of course, they haven't been looking, but the more likely possibility is that this starts by going to a dimer phase and then asking what happens. So in three dimensions, it's actually harder to stabilize dimer phases, but once you've got a dimer phase, it's easier to get a liquid phase. And the place where this is probably going to break down is in the way from the magnet to the dimers, not in the way from the dimers to the liquid. Whereas in two dimensions, it's easier to get from the magnet to the dimer, but harder to get from the dimer to the liquid.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Just to use this opportunity to advertise this lattice, the particle lattice will be the subject of the next talk. I don't have these PowerPoint graphs, so make sure that you remember what it looks like.
It'll
be a quiz.
Okay. So I don't use PowerPoint. So this is the pyrochlore lattice. It's your last chance to see it. The important feature of the several crucial features, but the things that you have to know for the time being here is that it's made up of tetrahedra. And these tetrahedra are arranged to share corners. And there are two types of tetrahedra called the up tetrahedron and the down tetrahedron. And they form a bipartite lattice. And if you look at the lattice that these tetrahedra form, it's in fact a diamond lattice. So in the next few transparencies, I want to talk about classical spins on the pyrochlore lattice. And the connection to what I've been saying before and what I will say afterwards is hopefully going to become clear in the process. So the important thing about the pyrochlore lattice is that the ground states of an antiferromagnet have a zero total spin on each tetrahedron, and that the ground state are hugely degenerate. So most famously, the Ising model, which is also known as spin ice, has the residual Pauling entropy of 1/2 log 3/2. So this is just an estimate, but it's very accurate. And in the Heisenberg case, it's what's called a cooperative paramagnet. That is to say, if you just have a Heisenberg model on the pyrochlore lattice, it doesn't order all the way down to zero temperature. But now what's the important thing here is that, as I said before, that the lattice of tetrahedra is again bipartite. So it turns out that out of the bipartiteness and the total spin zero, you can again have a kind of conservation law, which you can then use to again have this divergence-free condition. This is something that was done in detail by Mike, who then worked out the long wavelength correlations of this model. So I wanted to go a step beyond this, and I was asking, in the cubic dimer model, we were able, by doing a stupid lattice regularization, to get both finite size effects and short distance correlations rather well without really doing any particularly hard work. And so I was wondering, is there anything we can do here, a model that we can solve, which again gives us the correlations not just as long distances, which you can get from the effective theory, but actually at all distances? And so looking around for models which you can solve on this lattice, one that you can solve is just the ON model at n equals infinity that also has the ingredients of having zero total spin in the ground state, and all the other mappings that you care to do also work here. And so the hope is that the gross features and perhaps some of the more finer features will be reproduced correctly even for n equals 1. And one nice thing here is that you don't have any free parameters. So you just solve this model, you get some correlations out, and then you look at them. So what I've done here now is plot the structure factor in the HHK plane for the pyrochlore antiferromagnet. So here I've drawn it for the O infinity model, for which an analytical solution is available, and then for the spin ice case, so O1, so that is the Ising antiferromagnet on the pyrochlore lattice, and the two look rather similar. So I haven't...
Simulation?
This one's a simulation, Monte Carlo simulation. So I haven't plotted the Heisenberg case. It also looks similar, perhaps looks a little bit more like the O infinity. And so here, basically, by going to this ON model... Thanks. I was worried no one would get that joke. But okay, thank you.
That's
right. Okay. Okay. So, since these contour plots tend to be rather efficient of hiding discrepancies, I've actually plotted the real space comparison. So there are two different directions, these families of curves for different system sizes. So the thermodynamic system would just flatten out here, and you see that the correspondence is actually rather good. It took us a while that we were able to do these simulations well enough that we actually got statistically significant deviations, and they can be as large as 1.5%. But this is not really so important. I think the important thing in this context here is that by doing a really very simple classical calculation, which is analytically tractable, you can get an analytical form for the correlations, which is more accurate than any comparison you're likely to want to do is going to require. And so, as I come back later, so this classical calculation you can then use again to feed into some information on what happens at the Roxack-Hilleson point. Just for completeness, what happens to 1 over n corrections? So this is, we now believe, or we still believe, but the reason keeps changing, that the 1 over n corrections preserve dipolar forms of correlations at any order in 1 over n, the dipolar form of the correlations is not going to change. Basically, that's given by conservation, and this tells you why things are so robust, even though the fact that it works for n equals 1 is not so obvious because there's a phase transition in between at n equals 2. There are some non-perturbative effects, which I'm not going to go into. But one thing that I'd also like to point out is that this works for a more general set of models. For example, people here have introduced a three-dimensional model in the triangular lattice, which is isomorphic to the classical states of the Kagame ring exchange model. And it turns out that if you use the same method, you can again compare the O infinity with the simulated basically easing dimer type model. And again, they are rather similar. The correspondence is not as good as previously, so if you compare the curves in real space again, it doesn't look as nice as for the ice model. But basically, even though the treatment is not exact, it's rather accurate. And again, like this, for a model for which you have to work very hard to look for either an exact solution or do a cluster expansion or something like this, here you get all these informations rather for free. And pulling out things like correlation length is reduced to doing one integral then. So this is the Roxack-Hilleson point of the ring exchange model, which is a classical model, but it's
in
2 dimensions, right? So this is a case of a two-dimensional model for which an exact solution is not available, but where you can get the correlations out of this kind of treatment. And you can use this, for example, also to estimate effective stiffnesses for heights, height models in 2 dimensions. Okay, so I'd like to close with feeding this back into talking about excitations of these Roxack-Hilleson models at the Roxack-Hilleson point. So this is again something which was in the original paper which proposed the dimer model. And so I suspect most people know what the single mode approximation is. I just briefly introduced the notation here for completeness. So you define a dimer density operator, so this polarization E, that is to say the dimers point along direction E, and it's the Fourier transform at wave vector K. Now, if you have the ground state, in this case the Roxack-Hilleson state, you can find a variational excited state by acting with this density operator on the Roxack-Hilleson ground state. So just to, the comparison would be if this is simply the density operator and you've got a solid, then rho would give you a type of phonon, for example, at long wavelengths. What the single mode approximation allows you to do now is to find an upper bound on the energy of this excited state K, which is given by the following ratio, F of K divided by S of K, where S of K is the structure factor, or just the normalization of this state K, and F of K is known as the oscillator strength, which is a double commutator, which I've written down here. Since it's an upper bound on the energy, it's mostly useful for proving that there are gapless excitations in the system. Since it's an upper bound, it's not very useful in proving that everything's gapped, even though you can say if you think that this is a reasonable variational state, if it doesn't show you gaplessness, presumably the system is gapped, but you can't really argue that convincingly. So there are two ways of getting gapless modes, basically, within this approach. So one is if you get F of K going to 0 or S of K going to infinity. So there are different ways of doing that. So let's just have a look to start with at how you can get F of K going to 0. And this is rather obvious from this expression here. if there's a wave vector k at which this density operator commutes with a Hamiltonian, that is to say if there's a conserved density, then this commutator vanishes and f of k goes to zero. And the important observation, again, in the original paper by Roxanne Kiversen, is that, in fact, at the zone corner, if you evaluate f of k, it turns out to go quadratically to zero. And the way it goes quadratically to zero is that if k is transverse to the polarization of to the direction of the dimer, it's got a quadratic dispersion. And if it's along the dimer, then this is zero and it's just flat. And the origin of this is basically that you always create and destroy dimers in pairs. So you start from this and you go like that. So if in the density the lower dimer enters with a factor of minus one and the upper dimer with a factor of plus one, then the sum of the two is zero and it doesn't change in the process of the flip. And this is at the origin of this k cross e squared. So you say, excellent. If you're sitting at the zone corner, say, well, okay, this is a pyrochlore lattice, so the zone corner is in a rather strange place, but let's have a look at the, so this is the square lattice from minus pi to pi, sorry, from minus 2 pi to 2 pi squared Brillouin zone. If you sit at the zone corner, which in this case would be here, you say that f of k actually vanishes all along the zone boundary here. And so you'd expect an entire branch of zero energy excitations along the zone boundary. But actually, this is not what happens. And the reason for that is that this only works if f of k goes to zero and s of k doesn't go to zero at the same time. But what you find is that actually s of k goes to zero along with it. So I've just schematically drawn that here. If this is the zone corner, s of k always in these kind of models is this bow tie structure. So you see the bow tie here, you see the bow tie there. This is just, this bow tie here is simply given by a transverse projector, q perpendicular squared divided by q squared. And these transverse projectors quite generically come out of the treatments of these kind of systems with conservation laws. And the reason for that is that you're basically looking at interacting dipoles, and these things are magnetic fields. Dipoles have these kind of dipolar correlations, and the Fourier transform of dipolar correlations are these transverse projectors which show up as bow ties. So even though you would have thought that there's a line of zero energy excitations, in fact, there's only one point where f of k is zero and s of k at the same time does not go to zero. So exactly at wave vector pi pi, you get a gapless excitation. And the excitation has an energy dispersion which goes as k squared as you go away from this, away from the zone corner. So the excitations are only well defined. The excitations are only well defined if the momentum is perpendicular to the direction of the dimer, and that is to say there are transverse excitations, and another transverse excitation that you know is basically photons. And it turns out that the resonance that Roxanne Kiversen found in the original paper were precisely these photons of 2 plus 1 dimensional electrodynamics. They are anomalously soft because the Roxanne Kiversen point, in fact, sits at the edge of a phase. Normally they've got a linear dispersion, here they've got a quadratic dispersion. But just to show the difference between the square and the cubic or pyrochlore lattice, these are the same effective theories. In the pyrochlore lattice, these excitations, the photons, are all there is. These are all the gapless excitations. Here again, you see these bow ties, and the excitations basically live in a direction along these bow ties here. So these are the photons, the pyrochlore photons that feature in the title of Mike's paper. In the square lattice, this is different. Not only do you have these resonance, but in addition, there's a place where s of k goes to infinity, and this location is pi zero. Basically, this is just a soft mode. The system wants to order into a state with wave vector pi zero, and the way you notice it is that the density fluctuations diverge at this wave vector pi zero. So the soft mode comes along with an excitation, and since this lives at wave vector pi zero, we've called it the pion. And this pion is also gapless. And really, the fact that you've got gapless excitations is not a sign of criticality itself. Part of these gapless excitations are these kind of photonic excitations. And the special thing in two dimensions, what tells you that you're sitting at the edge, not of an RVB phase, but at the edge of an ordered phase, are not the pions, but rather the are not the photons, but rather the pions. So this is really the way you tell the two apart from one another. Okay, so this really completes this. So I started you off with high TC superconductivity, then went to two-dimensional dynamo models, discussed several RVB issues there, including the liquid and the triangular lattice. Then I talked about the Coulomb liquid on the cubic lattice. Use these kind of theories we developed to tell you about what happens in cooperative paramagnets, and this was in turn fed back to talking about excitations in these kind of RVB models at the Roxakiewicz point. So, summarize the different RVB liquids which have these features which are attractive these days, like fractionalization, topological order, their range of excitations, photons, resonons, and pions. I haven't said anything about realizations. So, one, the original motivation is correlated electrons. I've given you one potential application in frustrated magnetism. So, for example, the bow ties I showed you in the structure factor, in fact, are observed in some magnetic systems. The quantum computer I mentioned earlier, there was a suggestion of perhaps realizing that in a Josephson junction array. So, there's some prospect potentially of seeing this kind of physics in artificial structures. And as nanotechnology goes ahead, perhaps something will come of that. And then finally, of course, and since we're here, there's also the hope that cold atoms, which have got these marvelously tunable degrees of freedom and interactions, might also enable us to realize some of this. Thanks for your attention.
Let me make sure I got this straight. So in the cubic lattice, you would still have the gapless resonon, but not the pion.
That's right.
So in the
pyroclone
dynamo more at the end, we didn't really talk about it before.
Okay, so I guess the basic point there is that if you've got a tetrahedron, you've got total spin zero on the tetrahedron. That is, you've got two spins pointing up and two spins pointing down. There are six sides. Okay, so then, so this would be this spin ice type model, and then you give it the usual quantum dynamics of taking a closed loop of alternating plus and minus spins and exchanging them by alternating minus and plus spins. So it's this kind of S plus, S minus loop.
Oh, okay. Right. Or if there's the dynamo model and the diamond lattice, if you like.
Okay, right, but there are two dimers coming out of each side, basically. So it's really more like a loop model on the.
I guess maybe my question is the diamond model on the pyroscope doesn't have a gap.
So this is a diamond model on the diamond lattice. It's a very important point. Right. So the spins live on the sides of the pyroclastic lattice, which are the links of the diamond lattice. Right.
Okay, because so just ask a completely new question.
Right.
So the figure you showed was for the quantum diamond model on the diamond lattice.
For a quantum loop model on the diamond lattice. But the correlations that were shown are also those of a spin model on the pyroclastic lattice. Because the bond variables of the diamond lattice are side variables of the pyroclore lattice. Right. I mean, it's a duality. I mean, right.
So, Roderick, in this three-dimer model on the triangle, you can make these approximate calculations of dimer-dimer correlations.
Right.
Can you also do approximate calculations of these more complicated string?
All right.
What are they physically roughly?
So there are, in that particular model, you can get down to a microscopic expression for a bison.
Oh, okay. So it's a bison. So it turns into a string.
It turns into a string.
Yeah. Right.
And the spin variables. Okay.
Right.
So it would be some.
Yeah, I guess the
approximate calculation.
Right. The question would be whether that maps onto something nice in spin variables. Because when if you can express it in terms of spin variables, then it's easy. But yeah, no, I mean, it's, sort of by the conservation of difficulty, I'm pessimistic, but I haven't thought about it yet.
Exponential of something? I mean,
well, in diamond language, right.
And so your approximation is that it's a gap. I mean, you're approximating it by a Gaussian, so you should be able to do it.
I imagine there are many ways to generalize that string operator to O(n).
I think,
may or may not be faithful.
Yeah. Part of the question is, whether.
Exponentiation is something to
And one thing I should also say, that as soon as you have excitations, things don't work very well because ON is gapless, whereas these things are obviously gapped. So this really works for the zero temperature ground state properties.
Right.
So I mean, it may work. The question is whether you're taking these sort of square roots of spins as a particular meaning. And I mean, the dimer is a spin in that language, and these two monomers, the string between which you're looking at, are basically come from removing one of the spins, one of the dimers in the original lattice. So the question is whether you can find an operator in the ON model which looks like that.
But in this spin language, the correlator one was interested, it's really just a product of spin operators.
Product of spin operators. All right. Okay, I mean, this quadratic, so it's all Wick's theorem, so the question is what happens to Wick's theorem if you've got infinite number of...
Where you put the vectors
right.
on.
That's right. right, yeah. Okay. All right, if there are no further questions, then...